For coming. This is our second Saturday night Motzei Shabbos lecture series dedicated to topics in Jewish thought or philosophy. A few months ago we spent 3 weeks studying issues that were very significant, and as it turns out, if you saw the Jewish Times last week, we were ahead of the curve as we discussed issues of Jewish-Christian relations. And as we will see shortly, some of the issues that we'll be discussing in this series, while not directly related, but part of the focus on these principles of faith was, and certainly serves in retrospect, as defining red lines that distinguish us from other religions. But more importantly, than comparing ourselves or contrasting from without, the main purpose of our study, as I indicated a few times, I mentioned this series in shul, and really this is what where the title comes from, is really focused on us. What must we believe? And before I say any more about just even an introduction, I just want to take this opportunity once again to thank all the people who made this possible. The carryover from last time, both Dr. Eli Lassen and Mrs. Pam Lehman, who were involved in the coordinating of this. And we want to thank all of the hosts, and first and foremost, our hosts for this evening, the Schlossbergs. Thank you very much for this. And I did get a peek before I made the right into this room. I did see what's in the other room. And I was here when I came for my Shabbos tryout. So the first place I came was the Schlossberg home. And I thought they had served me well. But now I see what Ronnie's capable of. And I would have known, I might have had complaints. So it looks delicious, and thank you very, very much. One of the things which is not done that much in almost any school, day school, yeshiva setting, is really to focus on belief, on issues of philosophy, really what are we supposed to believe. I dare say that most people's familiarity with the Ani Mamins is much more directly from a song or a particular niggun, which you prefer, than it is from any class or shiur or anything that you studied. I think that's true for most of us. Why that is, perhaps we'll even touch on indirectly, but whatever the why, it's a tragedy. And I, again, to, so to speak, respond to that, I think vacuum is really where the purpose of this series comes from. And as we will see a little bit next week, and in particular in our final installment, especially in recent years, there's been increased attention, including some books and other controversies that are swirling around in the Jewish community, that specifically focus on these Ikarim in both directions. There's a recent, very high-profile book, which I hope to discuss in the third week, which questions whether these really are obligatory. Is the Rambam the last word, so to speak? Who said we have to have, quote-unquote, these 13? Maybe it's less. Who said we should distinguish between Jews who believe in the 13 and other types of Jews? That's one issue. And even in more recent times, not that there was a book about the topic, but in response to certain books or certain positions taken by Rabbanim, you know, the word kofer, apikores, heretic, it flies with way too much frequency in today's age. And the truth is, if you think about it, even if you want to take the Rambam's 13 principles as the barometer, in many of the cases, including a particularly almost died down, but a very active and current controversy in Israel and in America, there's nothing, whatever the issues were, they didn't relate to any of the Rambam's 13 principles. So some people want to constrict the list, other people are clearly comfortable, consciously or otherwise, expanding the list. So I'm not here to comment per se on either of those, but at least we should study and know a lot about this. A very, very brief biographical sketch, incredibly brief biographical sketch of the Rambam, just so we should know the time and the person, so to speak, that we're speaking about. We believe that the Rambam was born in 1135, almost the middle of the 12th century, and he lived right until the beginning of the 13th century. He died, we think, in 1204, which is, for those who heard Rabbi Kanterfogel a few weeks ago in Shul, it referenced the fact that this is the 900th yahrzeit of Rashi, but last year was the 800th yahrzeit of the Rambam, right? 1204 to 2004. So that's more or less when he died. He was born in Cordova, Spain, although by his bar mitzvah, when he was 13, he and his family had to flee. There was radical Muslims back then too. and that's who they had to flee from. They were in North Africa for 10 years. They then tried to go to Eretz Yisrael, but I believe it was about a year. They couldn't live there because of the devastation of the Crusades. It just wasn't uninhabitable. And then eventually, the Rambam settles for the rest of his life in Fostat, which is what we know as Cairo, and in Egypt. All the time that they were on the run, so to speak, the Rambam, needless to say, was a child prodigy, and he was learning and already writing. And already, by the time they came to Egypt, he was already very, very famous. He didn't work when he was younger. He had, you know, how much can you work if you're writing Mishneh Torah? He was supported. He had a brother. And a brother who was a very successful merchant. But at some point, his brother died a tragic death. And when his brother died the tragic death, he, the responsibilities of Parnassa also fell on his shoulders. And I believe more or less that that's when he took the mantle of medicine. And it's in that vein that he became in one of his more famous other positions, the doctor to the Sultan in Egypt, and he had responsibilities beyond the Sultan. We have writings from the Rambam. Again, it's hard to imagine any of the great Rabbanim of our generation from any part of the Orthodox community doing the kind of things that he had described he did. I mean, he went into the Sultan's harem to treat those women. I mean, just mind-boggling type of stuff that he had to do. He had an incredible, incredible life. Despite all of these responsibilities, it was already at this stage of his life where he published two of his three landmark works. The Guide to the Perplexed, the Mor Nevuchim, were published despite these responsibilities, as well as his single greatest achievement and the most lasting in terms of a book, the one that's probably studied the most regularly, and that is the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, where he takes the entire corpus of Jewish law and divided it up into 14 sections. It's also therefore known as the Yad HaChazaka. Yad means hand, but it's also an acronym for 10 and 4, 14, the 14 books. And he still is able to do all of that. Again, without getting into the details, I'm not a historian, and that's not the purpose anyway of tonight's lecture, but as you may know, the Rambam, certainly in those two books, was very controversial. Mor Nevuchim was very controversial because of all of the Aristotelian philosophy which he incorporated. And even Mishneh Torah, which is for the most part a work of halacha, was very controversial because, as he more or less says in his introduction, and either way you see it, he doesn't quote any sources. Everything is just his conclusion. Now, you know that he didn't make this stuff up. It emerged as a context, but he didn't quote the context. And he almost makes pretty clear in his introduction that he sees this, at least for many, as a kind of replacement. That this is a one-stop shop. You don't need to go open up the Gemara and look all the sources. All you want to know what to do? Just open my book. It's self-sustaining. And both of these things were very, very controversial, especially the philosophy. There were those who burned the books of the Rambam. You know, he was a controversial fellow in his day, at least in certain circles. He had strong defenders, but he definitely had some strong critics. The bottom line is, certainly overall as a person, and for the most part his works, you know, history was the judge. And Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam kamoshe, as the saying goes, from Moshe, meaning Moshe Rabbeinu from the Torah, ad Moshe to Moshe ben Maimon, the Rambam, lo kam kamoshe. And he really is that celebrated in our history. What we're going to be focusing on these 3 weeks is actually an essay, if you will, that is not included in either of those two books. It's not in the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim, despite the fact that that's a book of philosophy. And it's not directly in Mishneh Torah either, although there will be some overlap, and we will study a source together tonight from the Mishneh Torah. Rather, the Rambam's first book, which he wrote at a very young age in his 20s, we think circa 1170, was a commentary on the Mishnah, which he actually wrote originally in the vernacular. He wrote it in Arabic. It is Perish HaMishnah LaHarambam, or known more briefly as the Perish HaMishnayis, the commentary on the Mishnah of the Rambam. The truth is that he's one of the first, maybe even the first, great rabbinic scholar to write a specific commentary on the Mishnah. I once, when my wife taught at Ramaz, the principal there, Rabbi Eli Rubin, is a very fine Talmud Chacham. He once made this observation to me, and I haven't really, really tested it, but it always struck me as being a correct one, that was a... Even though there's really only, on that level of that time period, Rashi and Rambam on the Mishnah, even there's a difference, because Rashi, he said, really wrote on the Mishnah as part of his commentary on the Gemara. It was the Rambam, and perhaps therefore the Rambam alone, among the great Rishonim, who specifically dedicated a work just on the Mishnah. So even before Dr. Scheller, there was somebody who really took the Mishnah and made it, you know, something worthy of studying independently. The Rambam covers all of the Masechtos of the Mishnayos, and in his introduction to the 10th chapter, to the 10th Perek of Sanhedrin, which is known as Perek Chelek, which is a lot of philosophical, a lot of agaditas in that particular chapter. In his introduction to that chapter, the Rambam writes, I'm going to tell you now all the things you have to believe, what's important. And it's there that the Rambam lays out in a relatively lengthy form, again, not compared to an entire book, but it's not a short little essay. It's not at all what the Animamans are. We'll get to that in a second. In more detail, each one is at least a paragraph in its own right. Essentially what we call the 13 principles of faith, the Yud Gimel Ikarim. I would suggest that of all of the things of the Rambam, in a sense this book because of it, but really, if you will, to look at this in isolation, this essay is the single most lasting and impactful thing that we have from the Rambam. In other words, Mor Nevuchim is studied by a very small number of people. Right? Very few people in yeshivas study the Mor Nevuchim. In academic halls, the Guide to the Perplexed is studied to a certain extent, but even then, particularly because as great as Rambam was, he still lived when he lived, it's predicated on Aristotelian and other types of philosophy, which are simply not really accepted by the world of philosophy anymore. We study them and we learn from them, but those are not the systems of philosophy. So the truth is that even from that perspective, the Mor Nevuchim has lost a little bit of its oomph. Plus, it's also worth noting, again, perhaps another series in its own right, but even the Mor Nevuchim, even among great rabbinic scholars of the 19th and 20th century, who we would call generally more open types, even they notably, and it's almost ironic, went out of their way to criticize very significant parts of Mor Nevuchim, namely Rav Simchon Raphael Hirsch, in Chorev and in the 19 letters, specifically goes out of his way to criticize Mor Nevuchim, and say the reason that he needs a philosophy to write this whole philosophy of Chorev is because of his rejection of Mor Nevuchim. And in a very small chapter, an essay in the back of his least known book, Rav Soloveitchik, in the book Halachic Mind, which is almost all a treatise on incredibly esoteric Kantian philosophy, has a little essay, the chapter 4, the part 4 of that book, is all about Tameh HaMitzvos, rationalizations and philosophy of mitzvos, where he specifically contrasts Rambam's essays and his whole approach and the Ramban, Nachmanides. And Rav Soloveitchik makes a very, very strong case, very similar to Rav Hirsch's criticisms, that at least in this, we go like the Ramban. We don't hold like the Rambam, we hold like the Ramban. And again, this is from someone who his entire life hinged around the Rambam's Mishnah Torah. I mean, Rav Soloveitchik. But he made a huge distinction between the Mishnah Torah and the Mor Nevuchim. You know, my wife gets all nervous when I do this. Those many of you know, our youngest child is named after Rav Soloveitchik, Yosef Dov. So when he was a little, a story that is famous, the Rav wrote about himself autobiographically, I used to sometimes whisper into my son's ear, and then luckily for my son's sake, my wife made me cut it out. But one of the things was that he used to say that when he was young, he was very lonely, that he didn't really have any friends. You know, he was in Poland. He had one friend, the Rambam. He said this before his bar mitzvah, he said this. So I thought this is like the most beautiful thing. My wife looked at me like, what are you, crazy? I mentioned this to you not only because you should know that I am a little crazy, but also because you have to understand this is what the Rambam was to Rav Soloveitchik. And he goes out of his way himself to say, not so much the Mor Nevuchim. So there's a limited role to the Mor Nevuchim. Mishnah Torah is also very, very significant, studied not only by the Soloveitchik and the Briskers, but by every yeshiva, even if they don't give it as much prominence. But still, even then, it's theoretical. No one uses the Mishnah Torah, perhaps with one very small, very teeny exception, almost no one uses the Mishnah Torah to a large extent the way the Rambam apparently intended it. No one just uses that as their one-stop shop. No one paskins out of a Rambam. The one book that has real bottom line, tachlis, if you will, real impact on us, again, to the extent that we think about it, but again, it's major currency in our world, consciously and otherwise, communally and privately, are these 13 principles of faith, which somehow, and this will be more my subject in the last class in 2 weeks, but somehow seem to have been accepted by the Jewish people as traditionally, and obviously the last 200 years this has been a dividing line within the Jewish people, as the red lines for what is considered traditionally fundamentals of faith. So it's fascinating to me that of all the things, this is the thing. So we should realize this is not the prime objective of the lectures, but to keep in our minds, we all know to a certain extent how significant the Rambam was in the history of the Jewish people. If you think about it, again, you could quibble with me. This is just my own opinion. But I think, to the extent that I think about it, it seems to me that the single most impactful thing he ever wrote was this little short essay in the Parasha Mishnayos, introduction to the 10th chapter in Sanhedrin. The popularity, as I said, the quote-unquote universal acceptance of these principles will save, but certainly the popularity of these principles, without a doubt, owes themselves not to the Rambam's pen at all, not to what he actually wrote in his introduction to chapter 10 in Sanhedrin, but rather to two other works. One is the poem song called Yigdal, and the other is the summary, what's known as the Ani Mamins. If you look, and I didn't Xerox all of them because it would have taken pages, the whole book would have been of the Rambam. In future weeks, we will see specific pieces of what the Rambam wrote. There's none of the Rambam's actual essay has anywhere with the words Ani Ma'amin. That doesn't exist. I will believe. I must believe. I do believe. That's not in what the Rambam wrote. And what I've already hinted at, but let me just spell out explicitly now, is that the Rambam had nothing to do with either Yigdal or the Ani Ma'amins. He couldn't have. He had been dead for quite a while. Namely, just to the extent that we know this, Yigdal actually comes first, historically. Maybe that's why it got appended in the beginning of the Siddur, because Yigdal was the first one. Yigdal, we believe, although we're not sure, was written by somebody named, in the history books, they call him Daniel ben Judah of Rome. But we think it was in the 14th century, was Yigdal. I guess it's not recent, but it's after the Rambam. He wrote Yigdal, which is a very short summary. And then we had slightly longer and without a tune, until contemporary Jewish music stars started putting tunes to the Ani Ma'amins, is what's known as these Shlosha Asar Ikarim, the 13 principles, the Ani Ma'amins. This is anonymous. To the best of my knowledge, we have no idea who wrote it, which is itself fascinating. We think that it was in the early 16th century. So that's another 100, 200 years later. Again, still quite a few hundred years before us, but worth noting, it's also a little bit after the Rambam has already passed on. If you turn to your first source sheet, I just want to review with you. First of all, you should see, this is, of course, the typeset and pagination is probably familiar to you all. This is from the Art Scroll Siddur. This is, I have both the Hebrew and the English, because it's important to know what these words mean, of Yigdal on top, which again comes from, again, in virtually every Siddur. I don't know about Sephardic Siddur Durim, but certainly almost any Siddur Ashkenaz you'll ever see will have Yigdal in the front of the Siddur, and front of Shacharis, and the Ani Ma'amins towards the back. The Yigdal, as I say, is more of a, it's a little bit of a more esoteric language because it's written, so to speak, as a song. And what I want to do is just, you could take a glance at the Yigdal on top, but just go over with you for ourselves, because if you learn nothing else, because frankly, compared to the actual substance of these, there's nothing that I say that's actually, you could forget everything that we say, that I say, in the next, you know, 2-3 weeks. The main thing is, if you don't, to review and to know these 13 things. So let's just review those very briefly before we get into some of the analysis and study that I want to begin this evening. Just because I think the language is a little bit easier, I'll read with you again the bottom source, the one what's called the Ani Ma'amins. But again, you can follow along if you want. If you look carefully, there are 13 lines in the Yigdal. It's exactly correspondent. So what is the first principle of faith? Ani Ma'amin Bamuna Shalema, I believe with perfect faith. Shehabore Yisparach Shemo, Bore Umanhig Lakol Abruim, that the Creator is the one who created and guides all creatures. V'hulavada asav osev yasa. He's the only one who ever did, does, or will do. Chol masim. He is the one sole Creator. He makes and has made everything. Number two, ani ma'amin b'muna shalema shehabara yisbarach shemo yachid ve'ein yachidut kamohu b'shem panim. That God is unique and singular. That's what's known as Yichud Hashem. He himself is not broken up into parts. There's nothing else like him. He is singular and unique. V'hu levadu elokeinu ha-Yehovah v'yevah. He always was, is, and will be. Number three, ani ma'amin b'bunah shalema shabari baruch shemo eino guf. This is something we're going to come back to at the end of tonight's lecture. This is the traditional Jewish belief which rejects the corporeality of God. We believe that God is incorporeal, that namely that God has actually no physical body. There's no physical analog, there's no physical representation, there's nothing that can, so to speak, in a physical sense, represent God's essence. Number four. Ani ma'amid b'muna shalema, shebaris baruch shemo, hu rishon v'hu achron. He is, quote, the first and the last. This is a little bit more ambiguous. We'll find some time, I hope, in the future to study exactly what is meant by this. Number five, ani ma'amid b'muna shalema, shebaris baruch shemo, levado ro'i lehispalov, ein luzlos ro'i lehispalov. One shouldn't and can't pray to any other creature. Some of the men may remember that a few months ago, we studied this on Friday night between Kabbalah Shabbos and Maariv in the context of Seiskam L'Shalom, Barchuni L'Shalom, namely the idea of praying to angels or other intermediaries. This is what is being rejected here. You only pray to God. Nobody else has the power. No one else is appropriate to pray to. Ani ma'amin b'emunah shalema shehakol divrei neviim emes, the belief in prophecy as a concept even. And then more specifically in the next one, an imam ibn shalema, shenevuas Moshe Rabbeinu Alav Shalom, haisamitas, we specifically believe in the prophecy of Moshe, v'shuhaya av l'neviim l'kormi l'fanav l'bam achrav, and that he was the greatest prophet, both even including those who came before him and those who came even after him. He was greater than them all. An imam ibn shalema, shekol ha-Torah ha-Metsuya ata b'yadeinu, hi ha-Nesuna l'Moshe Rabbeinu Alav Shalom. The belief in what you might call the integrity of the Torah, namely, it's not just that we believe that the Torah was given to the Jewish people, we believe that what has been transmitted to us is virtually, if not literally, the exact same Torah that was given. Next, not only do we have the same original Torah, quote-unquote, but there's no expiration date. The Torah is never going to change, it's everlasting, it's timeless, the principles that were taught there are going to be forever. Ani ma'amin b'muna shalema shabara yisparach shemo yodea kol maase b'nei adam v'chol machshav osam shenemar hayotzer yachad libam ha'mevin kol maaseihem. Not only did God create everything, but as I once had a teacher once said, it wasn't that God created this and then went retired to Florida to play shuffleboard. He actively knows and is still going on. He knows everything that's going on in the world. He didn't just create it, but he knows everything that's going on. Very important, namely that we believe that there are responsibilities in life and that those responsibilities carry consequences. If you do good, you'll be rewarded, and if you don't do good, you'll be punished. But that things matter in life, that is the function of this animam, that it matters what we do, because ultimately we'll have to pay reckoning, God punishes, and God rewards. The most popular song of all the animamans is the the belief in the Mashiach, and that even though he will tarry, I don't know if my daughter knows that word, but when she learned the song, they taught her Beisakov, they gave her an English version too. So she says, even if he'll tarry, I go, what? She goes, you know. I'm like, do you? Okay. All right. No. It's good. It's all good. So she says, no, she said, we say, we believe in Mashiach, and even though Nabuch, it's been a while, and there's a lot of times we wish he could have come already, he's taken his time, so to speak, from our perspective at least. Nevertheless, we believe he's on his way eventually. And finally, again, it makes sense that this should come, these are the last two. Ani ma'amin b'muna shalema shetei tchiyas ha-meisim b'eis shi'ala ratzon me'eis ha-bar yisbarach shemo yis'ala zichro l'ad l'netzach l'netzachim. Namely, that we believe that eventually, even if we don't understand how it will happen or exactly when it happens, vis-a-vis Mashiach, nevertheless, we do believe ultimately in the resurrection of the dead. What exactly life will be like then, so that itself is a subject to the debate. But that's that there should be something like that is one of the core principles. And again, perhaps more significant or symbolic of its importance is not just that it's one of the animamids, it's the 13th, but that we know that, of course, that's one of the first brachos that we say in Shemona Esrei three times a day, of Mechaye HaMesim. It's a very, very central belief of ours. Now, to give you a sense, if you turn over the page, to how important the Rambam thought this was, we will be studying, and I've alluded to already, how significant this has been in the eyes of others. I hope, especially next week, we'll be discussing, even in terms of his later contemporaries, the other later Rishonim, how they responded to the Rambam and how important this was, even to the extent that they disagreed, but how they reacted to him and how he was, so to speak, the dominant player and that everything surrounded, so to speak, around him. And again, especially as I've mentioned, how they seem to have been, to a certain extent, universally accepted, although that itself has been in question. That'll be hopefully our third lecture. But it's important, leave aside what everyone else's reaction has been historically and otherwise, how important did the Rambam think this was? So if you look at the top of the second page, here I have from the actual Rambam's comments. As I said, the Yigdal and the Ani Mamas were not written by the Rambam. We don't know if he would have liked them, he wouldn't have liked them. They're summaries, and we'll get to on the next page some of the imperfections of those summaries, actually. But one thing we do know is what the Rambam did write. And there is a Hebrew translation. I don't read or speak Arabic, but there is a, neither do most Jews, which is why there has already been for many hundreds of years, a translation, a Hebrew translation of many of the Rambam's works. Mor Nevuchim was also written, originally written, not in Hebrew. And as were other works, Reb Sadia Gaon's, Amunas Fideus, which we're going to speak about shortly, also originally written in Arabic. So there were translations, and the most recent in what's considered the authoritative, from a scholarly perspective, the authoritative translation was written by somebody named Rav Yosef Kapach, who was a 20th century scholar living in Israel. So thank you very much. Temani, descent, origin. Thank you. I'm not sure I'll have to carry this to move back here. Okay, there we go. Gracefully done. At the end of the Rambam's own essay, where he, again, as I said, the original Rambam, which we have not yet seen inside, where he actually lists all of these things in much lengthier form than was just summarized and read together, after that, he sums up how important it is. And if you look on the second page here, I have this one paragraph, again, with the translation on the left. This comes from the actual, these are translations of the Rambam's words. He wrote in Arabic, but these are the actual words of the Rambam as opposed to someone else's summary of the Rambam. He says as follows, Ka'asher hiyu kayamim la'adam kol yisodos halalu. When these particular foundations or principles are fully known and accepted to people, the emunaso behem amitis, and they sincerely and truly believe in everything he's just described, these 13 principles, harihu nichnas b'chlal Yisrael. Only then does he, quote-unquote, enter into the Jewish people. Now, that is would appear to be intentionally exaggerated. Meaning, the Rambam is not questioning that if your mother is Jewish, you're Jewish. That Rambam wasn't denying that. But what the Rambam essentially is saying is that there's another aspect, if you will, to a certain extent from the perspective of ideology, a more meaningful aspect, of what does it mean to be Jewish? Not just to have been born Jewish, but to be Jewish. Not a good Jew, a great Jew, a tzaddik. Just bare minimum to be Jewish. Says the Rambam, again, it's incredibly sharp language, and when we contrast it with what he says in a few sentences, you'll see how strong it is. Says the Rambam, this is the red line. Without this, you're not Jewish to some extent. And what happens, as he says, and if you accept these principles, does you become, quote-unquote, fully Jewish, and then what kicks in? V'chov ala'avo, you have to love such a person as part of the Jewish people. V'chmo lov, to have mercy on him. V'chov ma'ashetziv Hashem, osan ozeh, alzeh, ben ava ve'achva. All the good stuff about Avas Yisrael, Jews loving Jews, says the Rambam, at least in theory, that is limited to Jews who are part of the system. Does not include, per se, every Jew. It is included in those who really, quote-unquote, accept the system. And therefore, if you get in the system, then we love you. Etc., etc. And even if you are then a very imperfect Jew, you commit all sorts of transgressions and averos, and you could be the worst of the worst sins. Says the Rambam, okay, he's not condoning it, obviously. After all, you will be punished, he says. Nevertheless, the bottom line is then we say, so to speak, a Jew is a Jew is a Jew. So he's a Jew who's a sinner. Okay. Aren't we all? But he's still in the club. That's if you've accepted something. Again, that's not because you daven a long Shemon Esrei, and that's not because you don't eat on Yom Kippur, and that's not because you keep kosher or Taras HaMishpacha. Those are all important things. And if you don't do any of those, so then you're an imperfect person, you're a sinner. Based on one of his own principles, we believe that you'll be punished for that. But you're still part of the club. You're on the team. And that has significance, obviously. However, he says, last sentence, Uka Asher Yifakpeg Adam b'yisod mi'elo ha'yisodos. If someone, you know, doesn't fully accept, if you will, or questions or doubts any one of these 13, harei ze yotze min haklal. Somehow he has left the fold. V'kafar be'ikar. He has rejected something that is an essential component of Jewish life. V'nikra min v'apikoris. He's somehow a sectarian. He is an apikoris. He's a non-believer. And we cut him off, so to speak. How far? V'chovo l'snoso l'hashmido. Hate and destroy. This is what the Rambam says. Now, the truth is, again, this is not at all our topic, and I don't want to get distracted by this, but as an aside, people shouldn't all of a sudden react to this and say, well, somehow it makes me uncomfortable and I want to just dismiss it. Who are we to dismiss it? But we should keep in mind, again, also, again, not at all the lecture series topic at all, and certainly not tonight's topic, but it's an important aside since we did read these very strong language. I don't want people on a practical level to walk out of here and do who knows what in my name. And if you do, by the way, it's the Rambam's name, not my name. Leave me out of this. But it is important to know that many, many of the great early 19th and 20th century Gedolim, both in Europe and even Eretz Yisrael, with Rav Kook and the Chazon Ish, both, pointing out that many of these types of statements which we have, and there are other more specific halachos. If you want harsh, I could give you a whole shiur on some of the real harsh halachos. That to a large extent, the assumption is that in today's day and age, for a variety of reasons, which I do not want to get into now, that those on a practical level would not apply. So on a practical level, this should not be translated into who knows what. But it's important to know that despite that fact, this is still true. This is still on the books. We're not embarrassed by this. We're not hiding this. You don't just want to advertise it either in the wrong crowd. But still, it's an important thing to know, and that goes to show how strong we feel about these principles. Again, this is what the Rambam says. So if someone wants to reject the Rambam, you know, at caution and at your own risk. But if you're going to buy into the 13, so the author of the 13 is the one who tells you, not somebody else, the author himself tells you how important these are. I mention, and I think it's important to keep all of this in mind, in light of a very important introduction. That is something that is mentioned, at least specifically, in the writings of Rabbi Dr. J. David Bleich. Many of you, really most of you, who are familiar with Rabbi Bleich's name are familiar with the fact that he is perhaps, in America at least, the single leading expert on all areas of halacha and interface with modern technological or issues. So on medical ethics, he's probably the biggest heavyweight there is. Issues relating to law, business, everything that has to do with somehow the interface between halacha and some of these more modern ideas, he is super duper unbelievable genius. He also was a teacher of mine. I learned Hilchos Kashrus, Maseches Chulin with him. He's a Rebbe in YU. And he also, professor at the law school. What is not as well known is that he's a doctorate in philosophy. And in his early years, well before I knew him, he doesn't do this anymore, he actually taught courses in philosophy at Yeshiva University. And as he writes in his introduction, as a result of some of the things that he felt were inadequate in terms of the literature and the published books that he could use to teach his course, he figured, you know, if you see a problem, solve it yourself, right? So we spoke about it a little bit at Shal Shudas. So he put together a book called With Perfect Faith, which is, if you can buy it, it was published by Ketav. I highly recommend it. Quote from it a lot tonight, and we'll probably see it in future weeks. Big, fat, hundreds of pages. It's paperback, but it's a real big, fat book, which is the wider discussion analysis of all of these 13 principles. And his introduction, which is very, very important, he points out that the reason that these types of studies, and he might as well, if you will, been writing about why was it so important that we're here tonight. And as he's saying, why is it important for him to write the book, which is another reason for why is it important for us to be studying this tonight. And that is that there's a tremendous misconception, certainly the last 200 years or so in Jewish history and Jewish thought, and that is that Christians are about dogma and Jews are about belief. I meant action. Okay, that was a test. You passed. You were listening. Christians are about dogma and Jews are about actions or mitzvos. Now, that's to a large extent half true, but not the half about us. And Rabbi Bleich, if you see this, I'm just going to paraphrase it, but Rabbi Bleich goes out of his way to talk about how big of a misconception this is. And he points out that that was essentially what the Rambam was trying to say. The Rambam, by writing these principles, was telling you how important it is. Of course, certainly on an everyday life of Jew, primarily that is guided by or that's animated by do's and don'ts, actual actions or inactions that we have to do, behavioral issues. But Judaism is not just about behavior. To a large extent, if you want to take the Rambam himself literally, if you want to know who's quote-unquote with us and who is maybe a good guy but not us, it's actually not about actions. It's actually all about belief. You know, I know growing up that I grew up in Cincinnati, and a very interesting community there, and I don't know who made these rules, but there were certain ways you could tell, you decided who was Orthodox and who wasn't Orthodox. There was like a few specific mitzvos. Let's take Shabbos or Kashrus, certainly the big two. So you couldn't say I'm Orthodox and not keep Shabbos. You couldn't say, but you could keep those two, and in other parts of your life maybe be imperfect, but okay, no one's perfect. That was okay. That still was called, quote, it's interesting that the Rambam doesn't have that at all. The Rambam says, listen, no one's going to be perfect, that we know. That's a given, unfortunately. But if you want to know, quote-unquote, who's with us, that's not defined by certain trophy mitzvos. It's defined by belief. If you believe what we're supposed to believe, then you're, quote-unquote, with us, and whatever your behavior is, more or less perfect. So that's significant. Again, it's important for the Rambam. That's the litmus test, not how many mitzvos you do, how much you learn. Those are all important things. I would be the last person, God forbid, to minimize that. But according to the Rambam, they're relatively less important than the issues of belief. More than that, right? Bleich makes the point, and this is, if you look at the bottom paragraph here of the three that I have on the sheet, that the Rambam, even though, as I alluded to when I mentioned the different books that the Rambam have published, so one of the books, the most well-known and actively studied currently, is what's known as the Mishneh Torah, which is the Rambam's book of halachos, of law. But what's significant is that the Rambam opens, I said the Rambam divides up all of Jewish law into 14 books. Who knows the name of the Rambam's first of the 14? Hilchos? Yesodei HaTorah. That's a book about basic beliefs and foundational philosophies. And in there, the Rambam includes many of the issues which we just saw from the Ani Mamins, which, as Rabbi Bleich points out, is, so to speak, a subtle way of saying there are halachos about hashkafos. Namely, it's not just this very wide divide of, oh, there's hashkafa, and, you know, that's, you know, you can just, you know, you believe what you believe and I believe what I believe, but then there's halacha, that's where you got to do, that's right and wrong. The Rambam put those beliefs into the Mishneh Torah to tell you that there are right and wrong beliefs. And a part of being a, quote, good Jew, and maybe even more than that, if you wanted to take the Rambam very literally, part of being a complete Jew, really, not just a good, before being good, bare minimum just to be fully, completely a Jew, is not just the do's and the don'ts of the actions, it's the do's and don'ts of the beliefs. So certainly, again, and as Rabbi Bleich pointed out, there are people in our schools of thought who are so committed to this idea that Judaism does not accept, so to speak, dogma, the idea that you have to believe a certain thing to be part, that Rabbi Bleich said it's been, so to speak, sometimes kiddingly referred to as the dogma of dogmalessness. Right, that they religiously believe that you don't have to religiously believe anything, so to speak. So we have seen, I hope, and try to demonstrate that that is, while that may be out there, it is a mistake. Now I want to put the Rambam's contribution into historical context. And that is namely, not just in terms of when he lived, that we spoke about already, but namely that to a large extent, and again the implications of this will be a little bit spoken about next week, but just to realize it as a fact, the Rambam was probably the first, in any meaningful sense, of all, in all of Jewish history, to make a list of a systematized Jewish theology. In terms of his quote-unquote contemporaries, what we call the Rishonim, the one who came before him who did a little bit of it was Rav Sadia Gaon, who lived in the 10th century, also wrote his book, Emunos Videos, Beliefs and Opinions, quote-unquote, which is was in Arabic, also been translated into Hebrew. And there he discusses philosophy, what Jews believe, don't believe, philosophical arguments, very much written as a polemic against the Karaites, who are challenging certain of those basic beliefs. But he didn't write a systematized, this is what you got to believe to be in the team, and if you don't believe that, you're off. He didn't do that the way the Rambam did. Moreover, and what's more significant, is that if you look in the entire corpus of the Mishnah, and the entire corpus of the Gemara, of the Talmud, while there are isolated pages here or there of philosophical comments, there is nothing systematized at all in Chazal. Now, exactly what to make of that and how much that means the Rambam was a departure, so that was a controversial book that was published, not the most recent one I was referring to, but one a number of years ago. And as I said, that won't be part of our study next week. But just to know that, there is one exception. But again, the exception is more of an exception proving the rule than an exception to what I said. And that is the very Mishnah that the Rambam was introducing. I said that the Rambam's list in Hosol Essay is the introduction to the opening of the 10th chapter of Sanhedrin. The first Mishnah in the 10th chapter of Parachelek is the following Mishnah. If you turn over your sheet, I have it for you briefly here. And even this, you'll see, even this, not only is it the exception that proves the rule, even this is not exactly what you'd call a full systematized list of Jewish required belief. Mishnah tells us, very famous, Kol Yisrael Yesh Lahem Chelek Olam Haba, all Jews have the potential spot, if you will, in the world to come, based on a pasuk in Yeshaya. However, you know, you don't get long, you get about a sentence until the all is already qualified. All, but perhaps not really all, not everybody. Namely, second line, Ve'elu she'ein lehem chelek olam haba. There are those who could do something in which they write themselves out even of that. Namely, so there are five things listed in the Mishnah. The first is Ha'omer ein tchias ha'mesim in the Torah, someone who denies a belief in resurrection of the dead. The Ein Torah Min HaShamayim, someone who believes that the Torah is a man-made document, that it's not divine. The third is what's just known, we don't get any description of what this actually means from the Mishnah, but someone who's called as an apikores. Again, that is colloquially now a much larger general term. But the Mishnah itself obviously has something specific in mind and didn't have in mind the first two, or else it would have been redundant. So, now again, not going to focus on that now, but it's just worth noting as we read the Mishnah. That's the end of the what we call the Stam Mishnah. Then comes Rabbi Akiva, the one and only, the famous Rabbi Akiva. Omer, Af HaKori B'Sfarim HaChitzonim. He adds another one to the list, namely someone who reads, quote-unquote, outside external books. What exactly this includes, again, not at all our topic. Then he has another one, Bahalokesh al Hamaka, someone who's whispering over someone who's sick, over some kind of a wound. He actually quotes a pasuk, but the idea seems to be that he's involved in certain magical hocus-pocus type stuff. That, Rabbi Kiva does, excuse me, I said before five, I meant six. Rabbi Kiva adds two, that makes five. And then finally, the last one at the end of the second to last line, Abba Shol Omer, Af HaHoges Hashem Ba'os Yosav. This is a reference to, we know, there's this particular name of God known as the Tetragrammaton, right, with all these letters, which in certain mystical prayers in our Siddur, we see the letters, and you look sometimes in the Siddur, like in the article, they'll tell you, you're not supposed to read that, you're just supposed to have your eyes glance over that. This is the one super-duper unique holy name of God, which we're not allowed to say. So Abba Shaul says, anyone who does that, also you lose. So here we do have, again, you can't say that it doesn't exist at all in Chazal. You have a list in a Mishnah, six things which can get you booted, if you will, to use my somewhat crass analogy of off the team. But what's interesting is even here, really, only a few of them are about belief. Right? Rabbi Akiva's reading books that you're not supposed to read, or this incantation, mystical, hocus-pocus kind of thing is not at all the same thing. And even there, it's so, not even here it's important, the Mishnah never says you have to believe X. It's still not an affirmative requirement. It's don't believe this, or if you do believe, this is the penalty. So without discounting the significance of this Mishnah, you certainly cannot say that this was, essentially just a shortened version, but more or less the same thing that the Rambam did. It's not. The Rambam was a tremendous innovation, a tremendous chiddush. As I said, how innovative is it, really a departure or just what I'll call an extension? Is he really just putting together things that were already implicit anyway, but he needed to make a little bit for next week? Part of the question is, if this is what I just said is true, is so then why did he do it? If it was good enough until then, why did all of a sudden the Rambam feel the need to break the mold and make this list of principles of faith? So here, if you look in the scholars, there are essentially two reasons that are suggested. And I think there's evidence for both, and maybe they're both true. It's hard to know. One, and again here I'm going to paraphrase it outside, but if you want you can read inside. Again, I could give you, if you really want, a lot of scholarly articles. I could give you a list, I could give you a bibliography, but for the sake of convenience and for the sheets, I included the summaries of these two arguments, again from Rabbi Bleich, that same book in his introduction. One reason that was given, which I think has a certain argument and measure of evidence for it, is that the Rambam wrote this as a way of education and defense against threats from without. As we alluded to before, and this I think is a good anecdotal evidence, just like we mentioned Rabbi Sadja Gaon, who was the one who came closest in Rishon before him to writing a book of treatise of philosophy, there's no question Rabbi Sadja Gaon wrote his treatise, What Do You Gotta Believe, What Do Jews Believe, as a polemic against the Karaim, against the Karaites. So many have suggested that in his own time, the Rambam felt the need to do the same thing. So in this source that I have from Rabbi Bleich here, on the left-hand side, that top paragraph, so one of the things that he says is just like that was done in earlier times, so to speak, against the Karaim, many of the different doctrines that the Rambam was espousing were done to also sharp lines, line in the sand, this is what we believe and not what they believe, quote-unquote. So for example, he says, we mentioned that one of the 13 principles is the doctrine of the unity of God. So that was reiterated, why? To counteract the polemics of the Christians, seeking to establish a scriptural basis for the doctrine of the Trinity. And as you know, to this very day, they'll quote all sorts of psukim that will, so to speak, advance the belief in the Trinity. And Rambam's saying, no, whatever the answer is for those psukim, we don't believe in that. We believe not in three. We believe in, quote, one, the unity of God. That's one example. Or, for example, where the Rambam focuses on this unique supremacy of Moshe. What's that coming to counteract? That's a polemic against the Muslims with Muhammad. So, v'chahena v'chahena, the one theory is that the reason the Rambam felt the need to do this was, so to speak, as a polemic from with, against without. And again, the flip side of that is to, so to speak, educate and reinforce from within what we believe, a certain historical context which motivated the Rambam. A second theory, which Rabbi Bleich, and this is part of the unique greatness that is Rabbi Bleich, because only he could do this, and I mean literally only he could do this, is that in he can now show you a theory, the second one, which comes, as he himself is aware of, again, he doesn't say it in terms of his own greatness that he knows about both of these, but it's true that it is unbelievably rare to put something like this together. You have on the one hand the famous professor Julius Gutmann, and on the other hand, Rav Elbel Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav. And I say he's the only one because almost everyone else in the world who knows about the Brisker Rav doesn't even know who Julius Gutmann is. And most people who know or study Julius Gutmann don't open up or know about the Brisker Rav. So part of Rabbi Bleich's intellectual genius is that he's in every world, and he knows everything about everything. And as it so happens, he points out that what's known in the scholarly world from Gutmann is also, so to speak, in the more Torah world from, this again, Rav Elbel Soloveitchik, who was Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik's uncle from Europe, took over for his father in Brisk, and then emigrated to Eretz Yisrael, where he lived till he passed away in the middle to late part of the 20th century. So he points out they have a different explanation, which is not a historical context, but a philosophical context. Namely, and again, here I'm giving you a very brief summary, the Rambam has a very specific, and to a certain extent controversial, belief in what Olam Haba is, the world to come. For the Rambam, it's an intellectual existence in which there are certain truths or other things going on that if a person has perfected their own intellect in this world, can have, therefore now has the ability to appreciate. But if you don't have that, if you didn't do the quote-unquote homework and the training in this world, and again, for the Rambam's perspective, it's heavily weighted on the intellectual side of things, then you're simply not going to be able to have that quote-unquote benefit slash reward in the next world. So what they suggest is as follows. Listen, but not everyone can be a philosopher. Not everyone has the time, not everyone has the ability. So what does that mean, as sometimes he's been accused of, that the Rambam was a super-duper elitist, and only super geniuses with PhDs are going to be able to make it into Olam Haba? So he said, no, the Rambam felt the need to have these more simplified. Again, it's not as simplistic as the Animamans made them into, but even it is, it's a few-page essay. Anyone could read that, and certainly almost anyone could understand it. Even though the Rambam might say, you don't really understand philosophy and Nevuah, how does the Rambam understand? The Rambam has a whole doctrine of what philosophy is, of prophecy. So if you just read these animamans that say you're supposed to know, believe in prophecy, doesn't mean you really, really understand it. But you understand it enough. Here the theory is that the Rambam felt, this way, at least if you know these 13 things, you read this essay, you know enough at least to get in. You might not be sitting, on the front row, right? Even in the garden this past Tuesday night, right? There's different seats. So for that was money. Right? The more you spend, you can get to the front row. And Olam Haba, it's not about money. It depends on how perfected your mind has become. So at least this is your ticket in intellectually. I think they're probably both right, or certainly arguments can be made for both of these. They're both true in the sense that the Rambam had to polemicize against Christians and Muslims, and it's true that the Rambam had this doctrine about Olam Haba. The question is what motivated him to write these 13, They're both, to me, very plausible possibilities. If you turn over the page now, you will see an excerpt of a chapter from a book called Hama'or, Sefer Hama'or, which was published about 80 or so years ago by somebody named Rav Elazar Meir Prale. Anyone know the name? Right. So, shortly, Rabbi Blau is coming to Baltimore. Rabbi Blau's father-in-law was Rabbi Teitz, and Rabbi Teitz's father-in-law, the chief rabbi of Elizabeth, a very well-known Orthodox leader in the early part of the 20th century, Rabbi Teitz's father-in-law was Rabbi Elazar Meir Prale. So he wrote a book, it was published about 80 years ago, called Sefer Hama'or, drushas and other types of things, and in his seventh chapter, he discusses the following. And just before I tell you what he says and what he's discussing, just to point out, for whatever reason, exactly how radical an innovation this was, the bottom line was it caught on. It was something that was new, it was powerful, and it has become very, very popular, very accepted, to the point that even though it was after the Rambam had already died, but whether it was the Yigdal 200 years or 400 years later, the Animamins, which we discussed in our introduction, not written, either of those, neither of them written by the Rambam himself, these were being written. You and I have the benefit of hindsight that I could tell you right at the outset that those weren't written by the Rambam. It's interesting that Rabbi Prale begins his essay, if you look at the opening of the paragraph on the right-hand side, where I have underlined, he quotes this book, Bo'otzi Yisrael, that says, Shaharambam Yasad Es Ani Mamin. There's someone who wrote a book that said that the Rambam himself wrote the 13 Ani Mamin, that which is in our Siddur. Ulam Ladati, he says, but as far as I'm concerned, it's not true. Rak Minyan Hayud Gimel Hu Kaminyano Shal Rambam. He got the right number, whoever this anonymous writer was, who wrote it, now we think, in the 16th century. Aval hikarim ba'atzmam shonim heim. Me'ela shal Rambam. This is an even bigger chiddush. Says Rabbi Prale, it's not just that the Rambam didn't write the 13 principles. It's not just that necessarily, if you take a paragraph and translate it into one sentence, you're obviously diluting the sophistication of it and summarizing it, that in a few important ways, they're not exactly accurate. And he has a two-page essay, and there are others who have done work like this, but he's one of the first, who have pointed out that there are actually some subtle differences between what the Rambam himself said and the Animamins that are in the back of the Siddur. So, you know, even the Rambam, even on something as important as the principles of faith, the rules of the game of telephone still apply. So just to give you some of the examples, he has a longer essay. I only gave you a few of his examples. I'm not even going to do all of them with you. But for example, look at the top left. Ikar Hashishi, what is the sixth principle? So if you remember from the first page we studied together, what's the sixth Ani Mamin? Ani Mamin be'emuna shalema shekol divrei ha-nevi'im emes. That the words of all of the prophets are true. However, end of the line here, that's not what the Rambam himself says. Ha-Rambam kosov ha-yisod ha-shishi ha-nevua. Rambam says that what is the sixth principle? That there is nevuah. V'hu yodeya adam min ha'adam yimtzei behem balei mimidos ulos, etc., etc. Rambam goes on to describe here the talents, asserting characteristics and attributes that a person would have. In other words, summarizing Rabbi Prale, the bottom of the paragraph underline, hine ha'Rambam mone liyisod. What does the Rambam actually say? L'hamin sheish nevuah v'yesh neviim. We have to believe that there's such a concept as prophecy. And not just that there was, you know, God talking, but there were people in history on the other end. There were people who heard. There were prophets. Famusag hazeh, and this principle, shonehu mimasha amar shenemar be'animamin shekol didrei neviim emes. That's not what the Rambam said. As he points out in some of the earlier paragraphs, it's not that per se the Rambam would necessarily disagree. They're not necessarily wrong. But they're different. And it's important to note that as much as we're familiar with the animamins, there's never, like in anything in life, there's never a substitute for the real thing. And it wasn't just that they were summaries. We don't even know exactly who wrote these animamins. It's hard to know if he was the most brilliant, spiritual, sophisticated person. They've caught on. They're basically accurate. But there are, and again, there's quite a few other examples here. There's a little bit more work. Different points, again, not major. Rabbi Prale goes out of his way to say, for example, on the bottom right-hand paragraph, Af shebevadai emesu kamo shenemar b'animamin. Even though it's true what is mentioned in these animam summaries, but it's still to know. The fact is they're somewhat different, and that itself proves, as we know from other reasons anyway, that the Rambam himself could not have written them.
Yes.
The Rambam himself addresses that, but that's, again, that's not the... Once the Rambam tells you that you have to believe that there's such a thing as prophets, the Rambam, not here, but in his Mishneh Torah and other places, discusses what are the signs for, quote-unquote, a true prophet is, and what are the signs of a false prophet. And again, a false prophet, we know from the Chumash, that's a capital offense, right? We deal very harshly with those. Just to give you one little example, though, one of the signs that the Rambam tells us is for a false prophet is if he contradicts one of the 13 animamins, if you will. Namely, if a prophet comes and says, not for a temporary reason, but that permanently, guess what, guys? I had a nevuah this morning, and mitzvah X, it's not true anymore. Or we're going to permanently add mitzvah Y. Says the Rambam, by definition, that is proof that this is a false prophet. Because that would contradict one of the principles, namely that the Torah is eternal, it's never going to change. So that's an example of where this interplays. But there are other aspects of what would be the false prophet which would take us too far afield. Despite the fact that this weren't written by the Rambam, despite the fact that there's some changes in the Rambam, from the Rambam, it's still very significant, and these have gained tremendous popularity. Someone recently told me that they started saying these every single day after davening. The truth is, that's why they're in the Siddur. Not all of us do it, but the reason that they're in the Siddur, right, after Shacharis, is the expectation that people will so say those every day. Where this comes from, I don't know how early it goes back, but perhaps one of the best sources for such a custom is what I have here on the right-hand side. This is from the letters of the Chafetz Chaim, as I've mentioned in other talks that I've given. So, you know, in Judaism, in Jewish tradition, we call people by the name of their book, right? Not by their name. So the Chafetz Chaim wrote the Mishneh Berurah. Right? It's an incredibly strange way to talk, but that's who we are. Right? The Chafetz Chaim is the name of a book. But that book, of all of his books, became so well known that somehow he became identified with it.
The third shame of
Sofer. Right. I think I may have said this, I'm not sure when, but I told you I once heard from Rabbi J.J. Schachter, he had a professor, Jacob Katz, who wrote many, many great books. But one of the books which he thought he might be most well known for was called The Shabbos Guy. And he used to lament that after May of Esrim, he's going to be known throughout history as the Shabbos Guy says. So that's who we are, right? That's what we call people by their books. So his name was Yisrael Meir, but he's known as the Chafetz Chaim. So he wrote letters. And in one of his letters, what's cataloged as letter 18, he writes here that to strengthen belief, to strengthen our emunah, namely, miminhag shenhigu hakadmonim lomar b'chol yom achar tefila asa yud gimel ikraya hadas v'heim yud gimel animam. Again, he's not talking about the original; he means the summary. That to strengthen our belief, to strengthen our emunah, we should read these every single day. And he says specifically in our days where belief is weak and we need to strengthen ourselves, you should read the yud gimel ikarim every single day. Just to give you a sense that that's not so simple, not so much on the animam end, but what's the other one? Let's not forget yigdal. Some of you may remember my first Shabbat Shuvah Drasha, where I lamented the fact that as a shul, we don't perhaps treat our minhag of saying Yigdal at the end of davening with as much reverence as we should. Not only because, and I think this is true, it's part of davening, and if davening hasn't ended, it's disrespectful to davening in the shul, but also because you have to know, which I don't know if everyone does, what Yigdal is. Yigdal is the animamins. So as true as that is, the bottom line is if our shul has the practice to say it, we should be respectful and reverential of it. That practice itself is somewhat controversial. And I have on the left-hand side, from the book Nefesh HaRav, which was Rav Herschel Schechler's intellectual biography of Rav Soloveitchik's practices, and this is something that's well-known in Rav Soloveitchik's name, he thought it was usur, it was prohibited, he was against the practice of Yigdal being said in shuls. For a simple reason, he says it's a very, very recent innovation, and he is convinced it was done for no other reason than to mimic the Catholics. The catechism, which is said at the end, again, I'm not an expert exactly in the church service, but apparently this, you know, to review their principles of faith is how they end their services. That's part of their service. And our Soloveitchik was convinced that that's where the custom of saying Yigdal at the end of davening was, and therefore he was against it. So there may be many shuls that follow that practice, and they certainly have him or others who agree with him to rely on. There are certainly many shuls like ours who do say it. But, so, again, also not so, you know, I know someone's going to come over to me and say, well, the reason I'm talking throughout Yigdal is because I hold it like the Rav. I am convinced that Rav Soloveitchik would probably be against us saying Yigdal and Shul, but if we're going to say it, he would want people to behave. Anyway, be that as it may, that is the controversy here of Yigdal. And I want to close the last section of my presentation for this evening on the following point, which is to just realize, at least from the Rambam's perspective, it would appear, how seriously he took this. I tried to really bring this point out in the beginning when we read that part about how this is how you get to be really, really part of the Jewish people and red lines, and that's true. But to give you perhaps an even more extreme position of the Rambam on the Rambam, if you will, meaning how he himself believed how important what he has now told us we have to believe is, I need to show you one final piece. This comes from the piece of Rambam I have underneath, where the Rambam, and this is again what Rabbi Bleich told us is true, the Rambam does include some repetition of the 13 principles in his Mishneh Torah, his book of Halacha, and one of the things he's saying is, he goes, I'm going to give you a list of who the, quote, minim are, sectarians are, apikarsim are. And one of the things he says is, I have here underlined, v'ha'omer shiesham ribon echad, someone who believes in God and the unity of God, aval, but one detail, shu guf u'ba'al tamuna, who believes in God's physical attributes. He believes in the corporeality of God. There's some physical being that's God. He created everything. He believes in all that. But God's physical. Says the Rambam, as we know from the 13 principles, even such a belief is considered heresy. So the Rambam here, this is nothing controversial, the Rambam reiterates that. But if you look right underneath that, the bottom left, the Ravid, who we're more well known, more familiar with in more halachic, strictly halachic context in yeshivas, the Rambam and the Ravid battling it out. So here they have a philosophical debate. Says the Ravid, Amar Avram, that's the Aleph Aleph, V'loma Karl does that mean? Why is he being such an extremist, the Rambam? Why is he calling someone who believes in God having a physical body a heretic? V'kama gedolim v'tovi mimenu halchul b'zua machshava. There were many who came before and who were even greater, take that, who were even greater than the Rambam, who, the Ravid testifies, believed in God having some form, some physical form. Where did they get it from, these other quote-unquote unnamed great rabbis? And here he's obviously doing them a favor by leaving them unnamed. L'fi ma sh'ra'o b'mikros. Yos termi ma sh'ra'o b'divrei ha'agaros. Ha'machshavos es ha'deos. They opened up the Chumash. God took us out. B'zro'o netuya. An outstretched arm. Look in the Midrashim. Look in the Gemaras. Look at all the Mamari Chazal that refer to God in very physical terms. So what are we taught from the time we're very young? When we go to school, they teach us. All of this is meant to be, right? Wait, what's the fancy word for that? Anthropomorphism, right? We're speaking in terms that we can at least understand. So we talk about God's strength in a physical term. But of course, we don't mean it. We tell ourselves that because the Rambam has beat it into our parents and our teachers and their parents. Okay. That, what, about those psukim. Right, but you, in theory, you could believe in God's corporeality and still believe that those are allegories. That's not a contradiction. The reason we say it's allegorical is because we can't imagine it philosophically being, again, even in first grade, we can't imagine it philosophically, so to speak, being true. What's important from here is not that the Ravid himself disagreed. The Ravid did not believe God had a body. The Ravid is saying that there were people who believed that God had a body, and the Ravid is saying, don't be so hard on them, because they weren't being heretical. They were innocently confused. And not just by confused by some itinerant preacher somewhere. They were confused by the psukim. Huh? That's what the Ravid says?
That they're not innocent little people. No, because
they made an innocent mistake. They made an innocent mistake. They studied Chumash, and this, they believed anything in the Chumash we're going to believe. They're not heretical, they're not rejecting, but that's what they thought the Chumash taught. This is what they taught Chazal taught. This is what they thought Chazal taught. So the Mefarshim who discussed this debate assume that the debate is, in most basic sense, the following. Not that the Ravid himself agrees with those others. The Ravid agrees with the Rambam that God is incorporeal. Nobody. But what the Ravid was saying is, if someone comes to a, quote, heretical belief, not as, so to speak, intentionally or active rebellion, but innocently and accidentally, accidental heresy does not make one a heretic. They didn't know better. That's how many understand this debate. What's significant is if that's the case, so I think I would, and probably most of us, would naturally raise our hands to side with the Ravid. You're going to throw the book at a guy who made an innocent mistake? Not only is it just mean and not fair, but it breaks the rules of halacha itself. If you'll tell me, you know, that a speeding ticket, so unless the cop wants to be really, really nice, saying I didn't know that this was the speeding, and even if you're telling the truth, they're not going to care. Speeding is speeding. But in halacha, we have a little bit more flexibility. We believe that there's a difference between mazid, rejection, intentional sinning, and accidental, shogeg. And a classic example of shogeg is not knowing the law. Why didn't I keep Shabbos? Because I didn't know that such and such is required. That's accidental. You're forgiven. Accidental. And here the Rambam is saying that's true for everything but belief. There's no gimmies. There's no accidental wrong beliefs. We're throwing the book at you. You're out. Even if it's by accident. That's a very extreme thing. So many people have taken up this debate. And I want to share with you, again, I'll paraphrase it now, but the next two sources, perhaps the most famous defender of this Rambam was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim of Brisk. And this is quoted by many people, including his son and other students of his. This has come down through the pike since he died in his name. And it's a very famous Yiddish idiom that you see from the Rambam, a nebuch apikaris is oichet an apikaris. It's too bad, it's a nebuch, it's unfortunate. But when it comes to matters of belief, what the Rambam is saying, exactly that. There is no issue of, quote, reward and punishment. It's what we call in yeshiva a metzias. It's a reality. Either you believe or you don't believe, and there are no excuses. Doesn't make you a bad person per se. It's a nebuch. But a nebuch apikaris, oichet an apikaris. Now, why should that be? Again, just to give you the two sources underneath, one is from what's known as the Brisker Haggadah, and it's again in his name, Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, his son, in his name. Underneath you have the book of essays called Kovetz Ma'amarim, which are philosophical essays written by a great Gaon in his own right, and a Talmud of Rav Chaim, Rav Chanan Wasserman, Hashem Yimkom Domo. We know, I mentioned that even this past year on Tisha B'Av, heroic life story, was murdered by the Nazis, Yimach Shavam, a great, great genius and a scholar in his own right. He also quotes the same idea from Rav Chaim Halevi. Again, in the Hebrew letters, they also write the Yiddish. And his phrase, Dervas, what is this here? I can read it. Dervas is Nebuch and Apikaris, is Eichet and Apikaris. Exactly right, as we said it. Why should that be? Again, just very briefly, I think it connects to what we mentioned before. The Rambam understands the world to come, which is what we're talking about, losing your portion in the world to come. The Rambam understands it not so much as a reward and punishment, but as a certain place of this intellect. And if you don't have the right beliefs, it's not a question of reward punishing you. But if you don't have the necessary ticket, you can't relate. If you look at the top of the next and last page, you'll see from Rabbi Bleich. Rabbi Bleich does his best to, so to speak, defend and summarize this position. Again, it's not just of Rabbi Chaim. It's really Rabbi Chaim explaining what the Rambam position is. And he uses what he calls himself a, quote-unquote, somewhat crude analogy. Again, it has nothing to do, he says, regardless of the degree of culpability, he has not attained the perfection required to enjoy, so to speak, the reward of the next world. Again, it's an issue of being philosophically and intellectually in the right place in order to reward it. The situation is crudely analogous to that of a student who fails to master algebra, that would be me, through no fault of his own, I hope that's true too, and must then be refused, I didn't try to enroll, but I would have been, refused permission to enroll in a calculus course. Such denial is not by way of punishment, but an assessment of the fact that one who has not mastered the rudiments of a subject cannot profit from advanced instruction in that discipline. It's the Rambam, if you will, consistent, l'shitaso. How the Rambam doesn't understand that the world to come is just, you did a good job in this world, we're going to reward you, go to the next. The Rambam understands that there's a more direct connection. If you are the kind of person, which again has to do with leading a good life, being philosophically sophisticated, if you do that, then you are the type of person that can enjoy the next life. But if you're not that kind of person, even if it's not your fault, it's nebuch, we feel bad. But what could we do? It's harsh, but that's the way it is. That apparently is how strong the Rambam felt. So not just the Rambam himself has these positions, not just the Rambam says this is the red line, this is how you get in to be on the team, if you will, this is what makes you fully Jewish. The Rambam takes it so far as to say there's not even an allowance for an accidental or well-intentioned mistake. Just to let you know and to put it in context as we conclude, this was not accepted by everyone. First of all, obviously it was not accepted by the Ravid, the Rabban V'Tovim Mimenu, but more than that, the Sefer HaRikarim, which was written in the 15th century by Rav Yosef Albo, we'll see more from him next week. His whole book is to argue on the Rambam's 13 principles. According to the Rav Yosef Albo, there's only three principles of faith. But one of the points he makes right in the beginning of his book He writes it here again. I underlined it, but you can read it for yourself. The Hebrew, that all of this is only true if you intentionally, consciously reject one of the belief's principles. But if it's only an accident, if you're a shogeg, so it's no different than being accidental in any other area, you're not culpable. The Radvaz, who was a great, great posek and author of almost 10,000 extant tshuvas that we have, the Radvaz himself, Rav David ben Shlomo ben Zimra, who lived in the 15th and 16th centuries, born in Spain, also a very fascinating life, went from Spain, then to Israel, then to Cairo, then back to Israel. Great, great author and scholar from the 15th century. So Radvaz, also in a tshuva, rejects this stringency of the Rambam. And he says, you know, if you're intentional, that's rebellion. But if it's just an accident, so that far we're not going to go. And finally, to close out, to bring it to you now from our our century, the final is a letter from the Igros HaRiyah, which is the letters of Rav Kook. And Rav Kook here doesn't quote this Rambam, he doesn't quote Rav Chaim, but if you take the Rav Kook at his words, he apparently disagrees. And I'll read this final part now to you, the underlying part. Again, we have beliefs, we have things that are very important, but nevertheless, Mikal Makam, he says, Lo matzinu shadanu chazal din apikaris. We don't see that our rabbis have really, you know, labeled a heretic, ki'im al ha-kofer, d'hainu ha-machlit, ha-hefech, v'ha-chlata shal hefech, yev shashim sal klal b'Yisrael, b'in shun odom shal yerosh ha-gomor, u'mashaker, b'meizid. It's rare, he says, again, we all know Rav Kook was famous for, no matter who it was, seeing the holy spark in every single Jew to an extreme. But Rav Kook says, in order to, so even if you don't go as far as Rav Kook and how extremely he applied that, and how generously Rav Kook looked on everybody, but at least the principle is what he says, that you only become, quote, a heretic if you are b'mezid, if it's an intentional rejection and rebellion. So again, he's not quoting our Rambam, but in context, it's clearly disagreeing. And again, it's not, the Rav Kook has who to rely on. He has the Radvaz, he has Rav Yosef Albo, he has the Ravid. So it's worth, again, I bring this to your attention because I think it's important to know in and of itself, but also because of what it reflects. It highlights how significant this whole corpus of discussion, all these principles are, certainly from the perspective of the Rambam. We've seen in his own words twice, not only the beliefs, but that paragraph that we started with, which was a summary, which he says is the conclusion at the end of his list, where he says how this is it. If you believe in this, you're part of Klal Yisrael, a full-fledged member, and if not, you're on the outside looking in. Very strong red line the Rambam himself draws. And secondly, we see in a later, in a different piece, the Rambam himself adds, and I'm so adamant about this, that it's either in or out, that there's no excuses, there's no accidents. Either you're in or you're out. So even if we want to disagree with that, which some have, but it's certainly worth noting how significant the Rambam himself, who we're primarily studying, in terms of being self-reflective about him, how much and how important he felt this was. So setting this stage, please God, the plan for next week, and I hope you all join us again next week, the plan will be then to focus more next week on what is quote-unquote the innovation of the Rambam historically. How much of a departure was this really from what the rabbis in the Talmud and the Medrash had done, or as the case would be, not done? And more specifically, we'll be focusing, limiting ourselves more to his contemporaries or later contemporaries, the other Rishonim, as I alluded to already before, of Yosef Albo and others, how the other Rishonim agreed, or as the case may be, disagreed with him, and what do we make of, and this I'll leave you with, what do we make of, now in hindsight, think, looking at our year from the 21st century, looking back, what do we make of a particular Rishon, who may be great about in everything else, who had a belief, the court of the Rambam is here heretical. Thank you for coming.
I'm always puzzled when you talk of the Rambam, that he was very much rejected, that his books were...
Yes and no, but there were some, absolutely, yes.
...were burned. You saying now that he's not studied as he has
been. Not the Moran of Uchid, but the Mishnah Torah is studied every day by thousands of people. The Mishnah Torah. The Moran of Uchid is...
Ellie, who's running the satellite link?